Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The executive director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this continuing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Well, thank you, Bob Kincaid. First of all,
sorry about getting my tongue wrapped all over my tonsils there.
Oh,
Bill.
That's no problem. Hey, listen. Hey, that happens. Well, I'm telling you, with me, that's happening all the time. Bob, I was just going to say it really is a pleasure to hear your voice on the program. We don't hear it as much anymore, so it's really kind of enjoyable when we, when you join us. So thank you.
It's a real pleasure, Bill. Looking forward to it.
All right. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. Today is the 28th day of July in the year 2020. As I mentioned, it is a Tuesday. And as I mentioned yesterday, we're going to have to suspend the program at the end of the first hour today, I do believe, because I've got cable company coming. And all they would give me is the 2 to 5 time frame. So Bob had said just a few moments ago before we came on the air that if we go over, it'd be okay. He thought that we might want to go over, and if they came, we could just cut it then. And that's I don't know exactly how to deal with that in terms of planning the coverage of subject matter and all that other stuff. So I think it would be neater and easier if we just went with the original announcement from yesterday that we'll suspend at the end of the first hour, and then we'll come back and we'll do a full program on tomorrow's program. Again, it is a pleasure to be with you. I do thank you for your continued support of this program and for your continued support of the Head On Radio Network and the efforts of Bob Kincaid, Agnes, and others to keep the network on the air. It's been on the air well over 13 years now. This program is into the second half of its 8th year of broadcasting, which to me is an incredible, something that is incredible, because at the beginning, I never even envisioned the remotest possibility that this program would be on that long. As I mentioned many times, the whole idea for the program basically came out of the so-called PRISM grant, history grant that we had that ended in 2013, in July of 2013, in the middle of the summer. And we had such a healthy audience of regular listeners because we had been doing so much of the PRISM program online in our live chats. If you remember, we were doing a two-hour chat on mostly on Sunday, late Sunday afternoons, almost every second week throughout the last year, at least last year, of the grant. And when we began to get a sense and hear from people about how many people were out there and how many people were regularly following these chats, it dawned on us, on Bob and Agnes and myself, that it would be a shame at the end of the grant to just drop the curtain on this whole thing and just leave that audience to dissipate. Since it was there and it was listening, why not try to continue to give it something worthwhile to listen to? And that really was what sparked the origins of this program, because I was aware, especially after having done the grants, and that was the second 3-year grant that we had at the time. If you will remember, our own West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd was the one responsible for putting the money into the federal budget for these grants on celebration of the U.S. Constitution. And many of us will remember that Robert Byrd oftentimes will take a pocket copy of the Constitution of the United States out of his vest pocket. And he had, at least toward the end of his life, and we know the first part of his life was not quite the same, because at one time, as you remember, he had been a member of the Klan. But not only did he reform, but he reformed to the point that he became one of the most outspoken advocates of the need for more citizen knowledge about the Constitution of the United States of almost anybody sitting in elected office in Washington, D.C. And so the fact that he made the money available for these federal grants, and I was fortunate enough to get funded on two of them for a significant amount of money. And I mean, this was the thing. When I wrote the grant, I really figured that the chances were probably remote when you go into a competition like this for this much money. I was requesting in the first grant close to $1 million, just about $1 million, and over three years. And, of course, what I propose to do with that is bring these programs to teachers and bring teachers at grant expense to the Concord University campus in southern West Virginia during the summers and occasionally on weekends, and orient the history, the teachers, those who regularly taught the Constitution of the United States, ground them in a more substantive understanding of the document, its origins, and its implications, and essentially the benefits that the Constitution of the United States brought to the government of the United States and continues to bring to the government of the United States. And that was the purpose. And when the grant ended and we started this, the second grant ended and we started this program, the first grant was for $1 million. The second grant was funded at $1.6 million, and it was a grant that was supposed to extend for 5 years rather than three. And so that would have taken us to 2015. And that's what the grant was funded for. But about halfway through the first year, we got word from Washington, from those who were managing the funds on the grant, that somehow the grant pledges had been overcommitted. And it was not going to be necessary to run these five-year grants for the full 5 years. So consequently, my grant was reduced from $1.6 million over 5 years to $1 million over three. So in a sense, it ended up to be pretty much the same as the first grant, a total of 6 years with total funding of $2 million. I was elated. And of course, one of the main reasons I was so elated was because I had never dreamed that I could be a factor in bringing that kind of money, money that is dedicated to the study of the Constitution, to southern West Virginia, or to West Virginia generally. And given the nature of the economy in West Virginia, to be able to bring that kind of money in, and to do it in the name of the study of the Constitution of the United States, was something that I still find it difficult to fully believe. It was more than a dream come true. It was a dream, because I never expected it. Nor did I expect this program, when it began, to go beyond 7 years, and now we're beyond the halfway point in the eighth year of broadcasting. And so far, knock on wood, and I'm banging on my wooden desk here, we're still going. So hopefully, I don't foresee the immediate end of the program, and I kind of hold my fingers as the years go by. But so far, we're hanging in there, and I know our listeners are as well. I continue to get emails of support from people that talk about how important they feel what we're doing is. They acknowledge, many of them, they listened on a delayed basis because they have to. But at the same time, they listen. They listen, and they enjoy, and they appreciate. And that's really all that I can ask for, or that anybody else can ask for. So here we are on this Tuesday, We have an abbreviated program today. We're only here for an hour. I have a couple of things that I want to address at the beginning of the program. And I have a couple of things that I'd like to spend time on during the program. Whether I'll get to both of them or not, I'm not sure. So I'm perfectly ready to hold whatever we don't have time to do an adequate job on until tomorrow. But I never want to deny our listeners the opportunity to participate live in our program should they be inclined to do so. We have an 800 number for that purpose. And that purpose is to give our listeners the opportunity to join in the conversation, to come on the air and share their thoughts, ideas, questions, concerns, suggestions, whatever they might be, not only with me, but with our other listeners as well. We have the opportunity through comments, through an email, or through comments through our Facebook page, to make comments directly to me. But people would much appreciate hearing these comments coming directly from the people who made them. And that's what the purpose of the 800 number is all about. So if you are so inclined, and you'd like to come on the air and join us on today's program, even though I grant it is an abbreviated one-hour program today, I invite you to do that. The number is 844-THE-HORN. 844-THE-HORN. Bob is in the studio today, and if you call, Bob will answer the phone, and he'll get you on the air immediately. So again, that's 844-THE-HORN. My email address, should you like to go that route, is waobrien906@gmail.com. And through our Facebook page, just go to our Facebook page on Facebook, type in the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution in the search box at the top of the homepage of Facebook. You'll be on our Facebook page, and you'll see a number of postings there. And after each posting, there's a comment link or a comment button. When you push that, when you hit that comment button, it gives you an opportunity to direct a comment directly to me. And the minute you post it, I get notice that your comment is arriving. I get to see it, and I can respond to it accordingly. So whichever avenue you want to take, please know that we would love to hear from you. I think I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that while we are on the air here, and now it's now just gone 1 p.m. on this Tuesday, Attorney General William Barr is appearing in testimony before Jerry Nadler's House Intelligence Committee in the United States Congress today. And what the topic of his appearance is mainly the question of what exactly is going on in the northwestern part of this country. What exactly is going on with the president's decision to send federal forces into Portland and now Seattle with troops sent to Chicago as well, and the president's threat, I don't know if you call it a threat or a promise, depending on whether you think it's a good idea or not, I guess. But it's the president's promise that he is prepared to send the same federal forces into a number of other cities in the country, and he named several. He named Oakland, he named Kansas City, he named Baltimore, he named Philadelphia, he named, obviously, Chicago. And there are many people, and I'll be honest, I'm one, and I think I mentioned this yesterday, who believe that the president's actions, coming as they do less than 100 days before the November elections, are not totally understandable without looking at them in the context of the elections. more specifically looking at them in the context of the polls, which show that the president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, is running way behind Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party in November, in the polls. And many in the media have said recently that if the election were held today, Joe Biden would not only win, he would sweep to an overwhelming victory. Reports are, understandably so, that the president's outlook for re-election is bleak, to say the least. Consequently, the president is desperate. And given that background, given that context, it's hard to believe that what's going on with the use of federal forces in the nation's cities is not tied directly to the president's election campaign. Obviously, in the last 3 months, we're still close enough that we can say 3 months, to the election, the president clearly has made his choice that his re-election campaign is going to focus on painting himself as a force for law and order in this country. And basically what he is saying repeatedly is that he will not allow disorders, he will not allow disruptions in our cities, he will not allow federal property to be defaced or defamed in our cities. He will not allow property in general to be defamed or to be threatened in our cities. And he will use federal power to make sure that that does not happen. He obviously has made a decision, and I'm sure those who are advising him are in sync with that decision, that his campaign over the next 3 months is going to be based on his determination to be seen as the law and order president. And it's in that context that the questioning, at least the questioning that I've been able to pick up on so far during the initial stages of William Barr's appearance before the Nadler Committee today, has been based on just this kind of scenario. Jerry Nadler, after Attorney General Barr was given the opportunity to make a 5-minute opening statement, members of the committee were given 5 minutes to question the Attorney General. And Chairman Nadler was first up, first to go. And he made it very clear during his 5 minutes that he was determined to establish a connection between what's happening in Portland and other cities with the use of federal forces and the upcoming election. So he used his 5 minutes through questions to try to get the Attorney General to admit that he and the president had talked about the president's reelection. And Barr's initial response to that, whether in fact he had ever been in a meeting where the president addressed the issue of his reelection, the Attorney General sought to get out of this issue or get out of this quandary by making the point that as a member of the president's cabinet, of course his cabinet has talked in cabinet meetings about the president's reelection. And so consequently, the Attorney General could say, indeed, yes, I have been in meetings where the president's reelection has been a topic of discussion. So what that required then was for Nadler to drill deeper. And it's really interesting as you watch these members of Congress use their 5 minutes. And I know, and I didn't see any of it this morning in the short time that I watched, but I'm sure if we watched this process go through the entire committee, if it's anything like previous committee meetings that were nationally televised, many of the members want to use their 5 minutes as an opportunity for celebrity, as an opportunity to get on television, as an opportunity to look good to their constituents. And so oftentimes they speechify. They use their 5 minutes to pontificate. But at least at the beginning of this particular hearing, Nadler and Representative Johnson from the state of Louisiana, the first two called upon, did not do that. That instead what they did was drill down on the Attorney General to the point that finally, grudgingly, they did get the Attorney General to admit that he had been in discussions with the President of the United States when the topic was the President's reelection. That's at that point, that's all I can attest to about the hearings because that's all I got to see. But let me stop there and make a comment. William Barr is the Attorney General of the United States. He is the attorney for the people of the United States. He is not the personal attorney of the President of the United States. Consequently, as Attorney General, William Barr has no business at all talking about electoral politics to the President of the United States. He's an Attorney General. His job is to represent the legal interests of the American people. When the Attorney General of the United States begins to and enters into discussions with the President on the President's reelection, he is violating his oath of office as Attorney General of the United States. At that point, because that's all I saw, all I can attest to, that's as far as I was able to go. But I do believe that Jerry Nadler and Representative Johnson of Louisiana were able to lay the groundwork for a line of questionings, which I suspect the Democrats will continue to pursue through the afternoon as the questioning goes on. But I also expect that Congressman Jordan, Republican of Ohio, who's the ranking member of the Republican minority on the House Intelligence Committee, will use their 5 minutes to do just the opposite. We have, and all of us, I think, have seen Congressman Jordan in action before, and we have seen the extent to which he has always been and undoubtedly will continue to be a passionate defender of this president and the policies of this administration. So I think that what we can anticipate, and I think the media rebroadcasts of segments of today's hearings will give us ample opportunity to catch up on what we missed because we happen to be tuned into today's program or involved in today's program here on the air on the Head On Radio Network. I think what we're going to begin to see is a very tendentious and I believe significant discussion and series of questions and answers related to the linkage or presumed linkage between the upcoming election, the president's election strategy for re-election, and the use of federal forces to crush, quote, the violence happening in America's cities. In fact, and I was able to present this on yesterday's program, and I think it's important to mention it again, both the mayor and the governor of the state of Oregon and the mayor of Portland have requested the federal forces, that the federal forces leave, that Attorney General Barr withdraw the federal forces from the city and from the state. And the mayor of Portland points out that the protests over the murder of George Floyd, which have been going on now for 2 months, had begun to ebb, had begun to decline to the point that even though they were still underway 50 some odd days after the murder of George Floyd, the number of protesters had shrunk to but a few dozen. And the protests were 100% peaceful. They were clearly in the process of ending until the federal forces showed up and re-inflamed the protesters, brought additional protesters out, and whatever violence, and there has been some, whatever violence has happened in Portland and might be happening in other cities as well, is due more to the provocation of the federal forces being there than it is to the murder of George Floyd. That's the first thing. The second thing that I would like to mention in this context is that I read a piece this morning which quoted the mayor of Richmond, Virginia, which has also experienced protests and also in the last few days has begun to experience violence and has begun to crush the protests. And the mayor of Richmond makes the point that there was no violence associated with the protests going on there until the federal forces arrived in his city, the capital of the state of Virginia. So it seems to me that Mayor Stover in Richmond, Virginia, is validating what the mayor of Portland is saying. And let me say, because I did say this on the air yesterday, that this is exactly what speculation tells us could indeed be happening. If President Trump is to portray himself as a law and order candidate, the law and order president, there's got to be disorder before the disorder can be brought to an end. In other words, if there's going to be law and order, there has to be disorder first. If the president's campaign strategy is to be successful. And therefore, given that, it suggests a motive for the violence that has begun to overtake these protests. The suggestion being that the violence is being precipitated by the very forces that are there to bring them to an end when they emerge. That the whole thing is trumped up. It seems to me that what we're looking at here is very, very serious and very, very dangerous. And let me explain why. If you go back to Congressman Nadler's questioning of the Attorney General this morning in the early part of the hearings, Jerry Nadler's effort to link what's going on in Portland and other places to the election suggests something well beyond the image of the president as a law and order president. It suggests the possibility, and I suspect that the hearings today, at least on the part of the Democrats, are going to be focused on drilling down deeper in order to find whether, in fact, this is just possibility or whether it's more than that. The possibility that what the president is doing is demonstrating his willingness to use federal intervention to crush violence in our cities, with the idea that violence is going to emerge in the coming weeks in our cities because the federal forces themselves are going to instigate that violence, that disorder. And if indeed that happens, if indeed disorder breaks out in cities all across the country, and federal forces are being used to intervene in these controversies, then the logical step to end that would be something in the area of martial law. It would be something in the context of using the disorders in the cities as justification for military intervention in the elections themselves. Because while the election is 3 months away, Election Day, November 3rd, is 3 months away, or a little bit more than that, about 5 days more than that, the election itself begins earlier than that. Absentee voting begins in about 6 weeks. That's only halfway to November 3rd. So halfway through this three-month period, people are going to begin to cast their ballots, their absentee ballots, by mail. And it's entirely likely that more mail-in ballots rather than less, despite the opposition of the president, added mail-in voting is going to become a dominant feature, a predominant feature of this election of 2020. The president has already replaced the leadership in the U.S. Post Office with a sycophant, with one of his supporters. One of his supporters with almost no experience to run an agency the size of the U.S. Postal Service. And the thinking is, the anticipation is, that the result is going to be a slowdown in the processing of the U.S. mails. In other words, it's going to have a direct impact on processing absentee ballots and mail-in voting. And when you couple that with the possibility of the use of federal intervention in America's cities during the election itself, what we could be looking at is a situation where the election becomes so chaotic that what happened a month ago in the state of Georgia would appear to be nothing but a blip on the radar screen. In other words, the fraud that President Trump has been insisting will happen with the expansion of mail-in ballots is going to happen. Allegations of fraud will be happening if this full scenario plays out. But the fraud will be the responsibility of the president rather than the president becoming the victim of that fraud. The election results will become tainted. The whole election will be thrown out. In theory, if the situation is drastic or desperate enough, the results of the election could be invalidated, and the final decision on who wins the election of 2020 will be thrown into the House of Representatives. And I remind you that while the Democrats enjoy a 40-seat majority in the House of Representatives, the Republicans enjoy legislative control over a majority of the states represented in the Congress of the United States. And if the House of Representatives is presented with the responsibility of choosing the President of the United States, the Constitution tells us that that vote is by state. Each state gets one vote. Each state gets an equal vote. It's not a vote based on population. It's a vote based on the equality of every state, which is entitled each of them to one vote. That would mean that the party that controlled the most states would presumably win the election. And that would result in the re-election of Donald J. Trump. In the broadest context, that seems to be a situation that we may be looking at. It's hard to nail down the evidence as yet. But there's no question that the pieces are in place for something like that to happen. And the only thing that I can say is, citizen, beware. This could be a rough ride. The pundits who have been predicting for better than 3 months now that when Donald Trump is in a desperate situation, given the fact that he acknowledges that he doesn't lose gracefully, and he'll do whatever he can do to avoid losing at all. Given that reality of the personality we're dealing with in the White House, this 3 months could indeed prove to be a very rough ride for all of us. It requires an educated, informed, involved citizenry. Under circumstances like this, the one thing that this nation cannot risk, cannot afford, is voter apathy, is citizen apathy, is leaving it to the other guy, is intentionally becoming disengaged from the process because you believe that the process is or might be tainted. If you don't participate, and a number of other people agree with you, I guarantee you it will be tainted. The very integrity of our electoral system is at risk here. It is on the line. It is on the table. And it's going to require all of us to make sure that our system of government emerges from this intact. Only we can do that. We can't depend on the President of the United States and his administration to see to that. Because in this particular situation, that's the source that could be the source of the problem, not the solution. I wanted to use our abbreviated time together. I know we only have 1 hour today, but I wanted to make sure that I had the opportunity to cover that particular issue because it's so important. And one of the reasons that it's important and today is so timely is because these hearings with William Barr are going on right now. Today's the day. Today's the day we begin to drill down on the degree to which some or all of this stuff might be valid, might be true. So with that, I want to spend the rest of our time today looking at the issue of Portland itself and looking at some of the things that might be going on there and look at some of the things that are happening within our political context today. What I want to focus on predominantly for the rest of our time today is a speech delivered at the National Constitution Center for the 4th of July, a speech which followed on President Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore that same day, July 4th. Because what is emerging here is an effort to paint a context for what is in the president's mind, what is in the president's game plan, what might be going on in the city of Portland that seeks to justify it. In his speech of July 4th in Mount Rushmore, a lot of us knew that he was making that speech. A lot of us know that that speech was nationally broadcast live when he was giving it. A lot of us have seen commentary and excerpts from that speech since. But I've got here a segment of that speech And I want all of us to hear that, this portion of that speech, in one hit, in one time. President Trump said the following. 1776 represented the culmination of thousands of years of Western civilization and the triumph not only of spirit, but of wisdom, philosophy, and reason. Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. So here we are on the 4th of July, a holiday to celebrate the independence of the United States of America, where the president is giving a nationally televised speech in which he addresses the danger, the likelihood, that there is a concerted effort, conspiracy, to overthrow what the founders helped create in 1776 on the day that we celebrate its anniversary. This attack, the president said, on our liberty, our magnificent liberty, must be stopped. And it will be stopped very quickly. We will expose this dangerous movement, protect our nation's children, end this radical assault, and preserve our beloved American way of life. Make no mistake, this left-wing cultural revolution is designed to overthrow the American Revolution. The 4th of July, 1776. 2020 at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota. This was followed, this speech of the president talking about a leftist effort, a left-wing cultural revolution designed to overthrow the revolution, the American Revolution, was followed by a speech by the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at the National Constitution Center, at which he unveiled the first report from the Commission on Unalienable Rights that Pompeo created a year earlier. You may remember a year ago when Mike Pompeo felt the need to create a commission on unalienable rights in order to identify them and rank them. Rank them. The whole idea of unalienable rights was introduced into the political context of our history by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, when he said that we were endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what that section of the Declaration of Independence says. Not mentioned in it was Jefferson's mention earlier in the Declaration's commitment to equality, to political equality with independence. All men are created equal. All men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Mike Pompeo talked about the unalienable rights. He neglected to mention the equality. What Pompeo did at the outset of his speech at the National Constitution Center was to prioritize which unalienable rights are the most important. This statement from Pompeo's speech is the one that needs to be given all the attention, I believe. Pompeo said the following. The report that he has holding in his hand, which is the first report from his Commission on Unalienable Rights, emphasizes foremost among these rights are property rights and religious liberty. And he explains that. No one can enjoy the pursuit of happiness if you cannot own the fruits of your own labor. And no society can retain its legitimacy or a virtuous character without religious freedom. Jefferson didn't say that. Mike Pompeo said that. Jefferson did not mention property as an unalienable right. The freedom to pursue happiness, was identified by Jefferson as an unalienable right. But I remind you that happiness in the 18th century did not mean the ownership of property and the freedom to pursue it. That's the meaning that certain elements in our society have worked hard to introduce in the place of the Declaration ever since. There is a theme that runs through our history of efforts to include property as one of the unalienable rights under the Declaration of Independence, and Mike Pompeo's speech is classic evidence of that effort. Indeed, it is not part of Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. The pursuit of happiness to Jefferson did not mean the ownership of property. It meant man's freedoms to exercise his property in religion, in freedom of conscience, in freedom of thought, in man's creativity, in his right to work, in his right to a just wage, in his right to fairness. In other words, I would suggest to you that what Jefferson meant by pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence was much more in the context of the equality that he mentioned just before that in the Declaration of Independence than it was to anything related to the ownership of property or to the issue of religious freedom. Because if you remember, Jefferson was very suspicious of religion because he felt that the political recognition of a religion would give it priority over other religions, other forms, or other evidences of man's conscience. And Jefferson didn't want that. Pompeo is an evangelical Christian. We know that. We have known that in many of the actions and speeches he has delivered already as Secretary of State. we know that evangelical Christians will do whatever they need to do under the heading of religious liberty to solidify themselves as the official religion of this nation. It is not, it never was that. The founders were adamant that it never should be that. And what Mike Pompeo is doing in this 4th of July speech is bastardizing the Declaration of Independence and the 4th of July, which was created a national holiday to celebrate it. This speech by Mike Pompeo is a travesty in so many different ways. In the same speech, Pompeo moves to Donald Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore. And this is what he said about President Trump. Quote, President Trump spoke about this at Mount Rushmore on the 4th of July. And our rights tradition is under assault. The New York Times 1619 Project, so named for the year that the first slaves were transported to America, wants you to believe that our country was founded for human bondage. They want you to believe that America's institutions continue to reflect the country's acceptance of slavery at our founding. They want you to believe that Marxist ideology, that America is only the oppressors and the oppressed. The Chinese Communist Party must be gleeful when they see the New York Times spout this ideology. Some people have taken these false doctrines to heart. The rioters pulling down statues thus see nothing wrong with desecrating monuments to those who fought for our unalienable rights from our founding to the present. This is a dark vision of America's birth. I reject it. It's a disturbing reading of history. It's a slander on our great people. Nothing could be further from the truth of our founding and the rights about which this report speaks. The commission reminds us, Pompeo says, it's a quote from Frederick Douglass, himself a freed slave, who saw the Constitution, quote, as a glorious liberty document. That it is, says Mike Pompeo. He draws from Frederick Douglass the fact that the Constitution is a glorious liberty document. But what he does is take that line totally out of the context in which Frederick Douglass delivered it. Frederick Douglass's speech is anything but a vindication of racial superiority or race domination in this country. Frederick Douglass's speech is something totally different, and we will go into that the next time we get together. We have reached the top of the hour, and as I mentioned, we'll not be doing a second hour on today's program. I think this is a neat place to suspend today's discussion and pick it up hopefully tomorrow. For Bob Kincaid and Agnes and the folks at Head On, this is Bill O'Brien thanking you so very, very much. I hope that you have a wonderful rest of this Tuesday afternoon. at the end of July in 2020. Thank you so much for your continued support. We appreciate it. Thank you.